The Honorable, the Judges of the United States Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit. Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having any manner or form of business before the United States Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit are admonished to draw nigh and give their attention, for the Court is now sitting. God save the United States and this Honorable Court.
All right, thank you. You can be seated, and Ms. Hester, you can begin whenever you're ready.
May it please the Court, Ann Hester representing Nathaniel Black. Under de novo review, this Court should conclude that Black's seizure violated the Fourth Amendment because police seized Black without any reasonable suspicion that he was engaged in criminal activity. By the time Officer Zastrow pinned Black's identification to his shirt, police actions would have made a reasonable person feel he was not free to terminate the encounter with the police. As in this Court's recent Jones case, this was not the seemingly routine approach of a police officer. Before the officers even approached, Black knew that police were targeting him and his companions for investigation because he had seen two officers drive up in a marked police vehicle, leave, and come back 5 minutes later with a second marked police car and two additional officers. Once the officers engaged the men in conversations, their actions made it increasingly clear the men were not free to walk away. Several things were happening simultaneously at the time Zastrow kept Black's identification. Zastrow began questioning the remaining men about their names and addresses, while at the same time, without consent, Officer Strayer had already performed a pat-down search of Troop and had the man sitting...
He'd already done a pat-down search?
Of Dior Troop.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
The first man. Right. He had already patted him down, and he had ordered the man sitting next to Black to stand up so that he could be searched. And also, two more officers had arrived, making for a total of six officers, with at least four officers positioned in a security perimeter around the men, isolating them and blocking their departure. Surrounding Black and physically blocking his departure is a significant factor effectuating a seizure. As soon as Black stood up and said he was leaving, Zastrow confirmed Black couldn't leave by telling him he couldn't leave and physically restraining
him. Did he say he was leaving, or did he just get up and start walking?
He got up and he said, "I'm going home."
Okay.
But by this time, the seizure was already complete. And contrary to the government's argument, the Hadari D case is inapplicable and does not render the search lawful. In Hadari D, the defendant did not submit to authority, and there's no application of physical force applied to him before he discarded the drugs that were seized. But here, Black initially submitted to authority and then was surrounded by a police security perimeter. When he attempted to leave the security perimeter, officers applied continuing physical force to him until they subdued and searched him. Black was never a fugitive. Police limited his movements to the area within the security perimeter. And under the Wilson case, the police conduct was a functional equivalent of physical restraint. Applying Hadari to this set of facts would create a rule that sanitizes an unlawful seizure if the detainee unsuccessfully attempts to terminate the police encounter. And Hadari D does not authorize that. Black's seizure was unconstitutional because Zastrow had no reasonable suspicion that Black was engaged in criminal activity. He identified no suspicious behavior by Black that occurred before the seizure, whether you determine that the seizure occurred at the time he pinned the ID to his shirt or at the time that Black stood up and he grabbed his arm to prevent him from leaving. He admitted Black and the other men in the group were not engaged in any suspicious activity, and there was no evidence that any criminal activity had recently taken place in the area. One of the officers testified that the men were just hanging out. They were several of them were standing, and some of them, including Black, were sitting in a semicircle in an apartment complex parking lot at 10 o'clock at night. While he testified this area had a high rate of robberies, Zastrow didn't testify that he suspected Black of being involved in a robbery or in any other specific misconduct.
You know, if you don't view the seizure as occurring until he's told he's not free to leave, does that weaken your argument at all?
It really doesn't, because the only thing that the officer had specifically relating to Black was his nervousness, which didn't occur until Strayer began searching the man that was sitting next to him. He ordered him to stand up. And at that point, Zastrow testified that Black began to appear nervous and he was looking around. But even if Black hadn't been seized yet, nervous behavior that's not beyond the norm for a person in a police encounter can't provide reasonable suspicion. And at that point, he was surrounded by four police officers. The men were being questioned, and a couple of the men were being patted down. And I think a reasonable person under that circumstance would become nervous and start looking around to see what was going to happen next. And additionally, nervousness in connection with a refusal to consent to a search and seizure such as Black's was, it was apparent he was looking at what was happening next to him and trying to decide whether he was going to try to get up and leave, can't provide reasonable suspicion under Massenburg and under Florida versus Bostick. So even if you decide that the seizure happened when he stood up and was told he couldn't leave, still his nervousness under these circumstances can't provide a reasonable suspicion. And particularly if the seizure happened earlier, you know, by the time that he was surrounded and he saw people being searched without consent nearby, behavior that takes place after the seizure is accomplished obviously can't support any reasonable suspicion. Finally, the officer's observations about other individuals can't justify seizing Black. Officers had to have a particularized and objective basis for suspecting Black of criminal activity, not other people. And the only people that they gave any testimony about being suspicious of were Dior Troop and another man named Gates, who were within that group. But none of the information that they gave was sufficient to establish a reasonable suspicion, even as to those men. But if it did, the officers explained no connection between those suspicions and Black. And the officers also testified about a rule of two or a one plus rule regarding the firearm that Troop was legally carrying. When the officers walked up, immediately Dior Troop raised his hands and said, I'm carrying a firearm. He had a firearm in his holster on his hip, which is legal in North Carolina. And the officers took that firearm away. They testified that they'd been trained on a one plus rule, that if there's one gun, there's probably another one nearby. But they admitted that they didn't have any experience in applying that rule to lawful open carry firearms.
How long have you been practicing law in North Carolina?
A long time.
Have you ever heard of that so-called rule?
No.
Do you know anybody who's ever heard of that so-called rule?
Well, evidently that rule is only taught by the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police Department. And one of the officers...
But it is taught by... I mean...
That's what the officers testified
to. I mean,
to.
Apart from the officer's testimony, is there any indication from anywhere ever that such a thing actually exists? I'm just curious.
I'm not that I'm aware of, and they didn't testify to that. And one of the officers who had worked in other police departments testified he'd never heard of that rule until he came to Charlotte. They didn't have any frame of reference to applying that when they find somebody who has a lawfully carried firearm. One of them testified he'd been working in that neighborhood for 3 years and he'd never even seen anybody lawfully carrying a firearm. And they testified that the rule wasn't particularly accurate when they did apply it. If the one plus rule made the search reasonable, that would mean police could basically search anybody who's near somebody who's lawfully carrying a firearm, as North Carolina law permits.
It would mean they could just make up a rule, create a rule, and then bootstrap their search through the use
exactly.
of the rule they made up.
And that's what Foster just doesn't permit. The court's recent cases have explained that the government can't just say that, well, we suspect this, you know, we suspect people who sit at a gas station for 3 minutes not doing anything or engage in drug activity, but they have to explain why. And they didn't explain that here, and they didn't explain why the one plus rule could ever be accurate. The rule would not eliminate a substantial portion of innocent bystanders, and the Fourth Amendment forbids it. The police seized Black without legal justification, and the firearm that they discovered in their search should have been suppressed.
What weight, if any, do you think the officer's entitled to give to the fact the person walks away and leaves their ID?
None, because in the Weaver case, that's exactly what the court said a pedestrian should do if the police are holding on to his ID and he wants to leave. Weaver says the person should just walk off and leave it behind because they don't need it in order to drive a car. So what is he supposed to do if he wants to try to terminate an encounter? and the police have his ID. I mean, under Weaver, that's what he's supposed to do. Thank you.
All right, Mr. Edwards.
May it please the court. In this case, contrary to the defendant's, well, let me back up, Your Honor, I apologize. First, I want to apologize to the court. I made a mistake in the government's brief with regard to the standard of review. It was incompetence, not in deliberate, but I stated the basic principle, factual determinations by clear error, legal conclusions by de novo. But then relying on Wilson from 91, I believe it is, and Gray from 89, I said that the determination of whether there was a seizure was a fact, one that was reviewed as a, on the clearly erroneous standard. If this were being argued in 1991, I would have been right. Unfortunately, and I apologize, later cases of this court have made it clear that that determination of whether it was a seizure or not is a de novo review. And I should have said that, and I apologize to the court. But whether de novo, excuse me, are clearly erroneous, there was no seizure here until the point at which the, no effective seizure as the law defines it, until the point at which the officer laid hands on the defendant. Taking it in order, when the police first got there on the scene, I'm not going to rehearse all the findings that Judge Whitney made with regard to the reasons the police were concerned at this point, except to say that when they got there, they were not, contrary to Davis and some of the other cases, giving some particularized suspicion to this defendant. When they got there, in fact, they testified it was Mr. Gates, the guy with the previous drug arrest, who was their main focus of attention when they got out of the car and headed to this group. Then Mr. Troop shows the gun. The defendant makes the...
Wait. They were going to see Gates?
That was the person they testified as they came back to this group after they had the backup pair of officers.
I thought they were following Troop.
They were, Your Honor. I jumped ahead a little. Initially, it was Troop they followed.
Right.
They saw him quickly get out of the car after parking in the first space and immediately go to this crescent or semicircle of five men.
Anything suspicious about that? That he gets out of his car and he quickly goes to the other people?
I don't think it's suspicious. I think it might indicate that he was fairly well acquainted with them. He didn't mosey over. But in any event, that's when they leave briefly because there's now six guys there. They want to have other officers in this area with them. And then once the other two officers show up, they return. The point that I began there in my middle of the story part is when the officers then got out of their car for the face-to-face conversation, the testimony was it was Gates, whom they both knew. They both knew about his previous record. He had recently, his arrest record, had recently moved there. And that's who they were focusing on until Mr. Troop attracted their attention by displaying to them his openly carried firearm in a holster, which they had never seen anybody have that before. That's when Troop attracted their attention. So Troop attracted their attention after Gates was their person as they were headed there. Then, later on, Moses, the fellow who did not, as in Massenburg, for example, did not already have his hands in his pocket. Instead, he put his hands in his pocket when the police were there talking, and that's when the officer said, take your hands out of your pocket, and did a quick frisk on him. Nobody had paid a lot of attention to the defendant other than noting that it was a little odd that he had handed his ID, unusual, that he had handed his ID over right away. It was only
when... Was he asked to hand it over?
He was not, Your Honor. The officer was asking, he explained, Officer Zastro explained that while Strayer was away securing Troop's gun in the car for them to, for safety purposes while they did this interview, he was making small talk, asking people, you know, were they just visiting, did they live around here, et cetera. Then when Strayer got back, he asked them if they had ID.
Well, so he did ask.
Collectively, the group, yes, sir.
That's what it is. So it's unusual for him to turn it over to the police?
It was surprising for him that Black immediately just reached in and handed that.
When all he was
at,
why?
Because at that point, he was just asking them where they lived.
You said he asked the group, do you have ID?
Mm-hmm.
And that was unusual for the man to turn it over to the police officer?
I believe that the actual evidence...
What was it about him that made it unusual for him to cooperate with the police?
Well, I believe the actual testimony was he was asking them where they lived and identifying information. And then the defendant... I'm not saying, Your Honor, by any means, let me back up. that, wow, you hand over an ID right away instead of first verbally giving that information shows that there's something suspicious.
That's what the police officer did. He said it. Oh, that was unusual that he turned it over. What is it about him that made it unusual for him to respond cooperatively and say, you want to know about that? What's the best way to show identification? Who you are, but what was it unusual about him doing it? I can't understand that.
My recollection of the testimony was that the chronological point when that took place, the officer had at that point was still just asking people where they lived. He hadn't gotten to the point of actually asking for the identifications themselves. Mm-hmm. He's asking, are y'all visiting or are you here? At any point, when it got handed over, when Mr. Black handed the identification over, that was done voluntarily. And the defendant doesn't argue to the contrary. That was a voluntary handover of the identification. It was after that point, while Officer Zastrow was...
Why didn't he give it back to him?
Because, as the testimony at the hearing established, Officer Zastrow was trying to get everybody's information at one time. And I believe it's a reasonable inference. He wanted to do a radio run to see did people have warrants outstanding, things of that nature. Now, what the defense is arguing, Your Honor, going to Your Honor's point, is the defense is essentially arguing that as soon as that ID got handed over to Officer Zastrow, notwithstanding the defendant's not saying, I want it back, notwithstanding that there were several other people there and they're trying to move expeditiously because you don't want to extend this, that it's almost like a chess clock. You hit it and suddenly the clock starts running. And the officer should have stopped everything, written that information down, when it's a lot faster to do it to the just hold on to it. I'd also point out that under this case, court's case in Anala, as well as in Weaver, in both of those cases, the defendant hands over, in those cases, driver's licenses. And in both cases, the court points out that the officer held on to it for a while to perform the checks that he wanted to do, that it necessarily inquired some of it, that there's a requirement to hand it back promptly, but that's not the same as handing it back immediately. And also, as this court stated in Weaver, and also in Anala, the defendant in those cases never asked for it back. So there was not a situation of it being refused. So it was not an extended period of time, the holding, nor was it a refusal to hand it back. In fact, in Weaver, once the defendant, who had been told he matched the description of a suspicious person, so he had been told there was some individualized suspicion, he handed it over, the officer did the check, and then while still holding the ID, the officer said, would you mind coming with me to a bank, you know, that just got robbed? And the defendant gets into a patrol car and goes with him. All the while, the officer's holding the ID. Contrasting that with this case, the officer gets the ID, he holds on to it, in fact, pins it there in plain view, and that was something else this court has noted in the Anala case. The officer, the court spoke with approval of the fact the officer there didn't take the ID and go put it in the squad car. He kept it near the defendant. Here, the officer keeps it right out there in plain view, starts getting the other information. Again, the reasonable inference for purposes of doing a check to see if there's outstanding warrants or things of that nature, when suddenly, to his surprise, the defendant starts getting nervous right after Mr. Moses, the man who put his hands in his pockets, gets searched. At that point still, the defendant has not been seized. The defendant is there. He's free, as in Weaver, to ask to have it back or in Anala.
Or walk off, right?
Or to walk off, absolutely. Mm-hmm. If that is all he had done, Your Honor, if he decided, well, this is enough, I think I'm leaving, without more, we would have a much different situation. But in this case, he acted extremely nervous. And to go to Your Honor's point about, well, what's so unusual about somebody handing an ID over? In and of itself, not necessarily so, but the 180-degree turn of, he was the most cooperative of the group initially. The rest, the testimony was, weren't that happy about dealing with the cops that evening. But on the other hand, suddenly he became the least cooperative, and he's the one who decides, this ID, which is so important if you read the defendant's brief, this ID is so important, you know, I don't need it anymore, and I'm looking around suddenly to get out of there. The defendant's argument, so this 180-degree turn in particular with regard to this defendant caused a suspicion, which then caused the attempted seizure by the police. When they said, stop, you're not free to go. That was clearly an attempted seizure. That, for the first time, is the assertion of authority that Hodari, as well as other cases that do not involve just a pure flight from the beginning, like Wardlow or Hodari, other cases where it's a continuing thing and then somebody starts to go on, that is where there's an attempted seizure, but no submission to the assertion of lawful authority. The first time the police ever tried to assert lawful authority here was when they told this man, stop, you're not free to go. And they made that explicit, that phrase, you're not free to go. At that point, they attempted to seize him. Still, no laying on of hands. Sounds like a church service, but no laying on of hands. It is just the pure verbal assertion. So under the Hodari, either physical touching or submission, we're still in some, assertion of authority.
So your argument is that a demand by a law enforcement officer for identification from a citizen is not an assertion of authority?
Your Honor, yes, sir. First of all, I'm not trying to quibble with words, but I would disagree with the demand. And there's ample case law for both from this court and from the Supreme Court that officers are free to walk up and interrogate, is the word the Supreme Court uses, interrogate citizens about identification, to ask for identification, and that does not constitute a seizure. And if it doesn't constitute a seizure, then therefore it
was
not.
I didn't say, does it constitute a seizure? I asked, was it an assertion of authority? And if you don't like the word demand, okay, a request,
yes,
of a pedestrian, not a motorist or a driver's license. But an officer walks up to a pedestrian and asks for identification, your argument is that that's not an assertion of authority.
That is correct, Your Honor, based on the case law. If the officer asks for that, without more, the officer asks for that authority, asks for that identification. And if a person hands it over, that alone is not, because all reported cases in which we have the case law saying an officer is free to go up and ask that. In all those cases, a person has submitted. So that's a submission to that request. If that were enough to be a seizure, all these cases that say that's not a seizure would be wrong. So no, asking alone is not a seizure. That's what the case law says, both from this court.
I didn't say it was a seizure. I asked, is it an assertion of authority?
I agree, Your Honor. And I guess I was jumping to the third point of that syllogism, which is, since there's no physical touching, it has to be an assertion of authority.
Well, the soundness of a syllogism depends on the primary proposition, doesn't it?
It does, and the secondary one. The primary one would be, since there's no physical touching, was there an assertion of authority?
And
the second
say,
one being, was there submission?
You say it wasn't an assertion.
And I'm saying there must not be, because since in those reported cases there was a submission, that is, the person handed it over, we've got the secondary premise, yet the conclusion is not that it was a seizure. Therefore, the first premise must not be applicable, that is, that it was a demand.
I didn't think you constructed a syllogism from the conclusion backwards.
No, I realize that, Your Honor, but what I'm saying is,
I think that's what you just did, though.
If the courts have reached the conclusion that it was not a seizure, where there has been submission. If the courts have reached
starting with the conclusion.
I am.
And you're working backwards.
Because as a matter
of fact, there must not have been an assertion of authority because the court said it wasn't a seizure.
And the court
I think you've got your syllogism turned upside down.
I'll go back and take more logic, read more logically. It's been a long time since I've discussed major and minor premises. But in this case, though, as I say, at the earliest there was an assertion of authority, therefore, was when they told him, stop. Up to that point, he's number four on the hit parade. They're not individualized looking at him. They haven't told him that you're a suspect. They've barely talked to him at all, in fact. It's the other people who've attracted their attention.
Counsel, I know you're representing the United States here, but you can't really seriously say that. Six police officers, patrol cars, armed, surrounding the group, and they come up to them, and they said, "What are y'all doing? You got an identity? Who are you guys?" That's not an assertion of authority. It's all authority. The police cars, badges, guns—they surround you. What else you want to do? Smack them? I mean, my goodness, that is assertion. The question is the case you're talking about, where a person doesn't even submit to even an assertion of authority, not search. That's what Judge Davis was trying to get you in the formal logic aspect of, is that it's a fallacy in terms of your conclusion. That's what he was talking about, formal logic. But those are cases where they don't submit to the assertion of authority. Like, hey, what are you doing? That's not a seizure. It's authority. You say, and they bolt. Well, the case law says, well, if you do that, person, they can follow through. And then if they tackle you, and then in that tackling, the gun falls out. This case is totally different. They encircle them. Came up to them, said that, and he did. He did submit to the assertion of authority, whether it's arrest or not. Here's my ID, and sat there. And then when he says, I'm tired of playing this game. I'm going to go home. And stepped in front of him. You can't go home. What? You mean to tell me I can't even go home? No, no, you can't. For example, a citizen is on the street, a pedestrian, and you said a police officer can ask for their ID and talk to them?
Yes, sir.
Does the citizen have to talk to the police officer?
Absolutely not, Your Honor.
Can they walk away?
If there's no other suspicious circumstances just based on that citizen right. A scenario, absolutely.
Right, but you can't create the reason for searches that when I asked them to talk to them, they got nervous and walked away. Everyone gets nervous. That's part of it. You said, no, I'm a little nervous about this. I want to walk away. You said, oh, aha, they were nervous. Now I can search you.
Mm-hmm.
That's the extent of your logic. Is it not?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Is it not the extent of your logic? Because you say only when they put their hands on him. That's what you said.
I don't believe so, Your Honor, because...
Oh, I thought that's what you said.
Well, that was what I was trying to say. Maybe I should leave it to that. First of all, although Your Honor has pointed out there were six officers there, there were only two who were interacting with the people. The other officers,
circling around. They were on the perimeter.
On the perimeter, at least 10 to 15 feet away, it sounded like, and the testimony was...
You mean as close as I am to you? 10
yes,
to 15
sir.
Feet?
Oh, okay. Yes, sir. And the testimony was they were there to try to prevent other people from walking up onto the scene.
What other people?
It's a public parking lot and a
there was
housing
no evidence.
Complex.
Is there a record that the people were gathering around?
No, there was no testimony about that.
I didn't think so. Go ahead.
No, sir. Okay. And so they're at some remove from these folks. It was only the two officers who were actually interacting with them. So, and there were sort of a balance of forces, you could say. There were six police officers. There were six citizens there.
That's the balance of forces.
Well, what I mean is, it's not as if there were one passenger in an airport, for example, and suddenly there's six cops standing around them.
Okay.
That this was, and impeding his flow. This was, I don't know if they were at the four points of the compass or what, but the perimeter officers were out there, but there are also six people who are being talked to. So that is not the factor that the defendant portrays as far as being a surrounding. Secondly, the defendant, again, was never the focus of anything until the point at which the officers looked at him because he was acting very nervous. And that nervousness, Your Honor, again, you're right. Most people are very nervous. I think I'd be nervous and, you know, I might.
I know I'd be nervous.
Absolutely. But on the other hand, the defendant, and that I think is the significance of how he had been extremely conversational, friendly, et cetera, initially. And it's only when he sees what ultimately result, the frisk of Troop, the guy with the gun, and then Moses, the guy with his hands pockets. That's when the testimony is clear. He decides to get up and leave. I'd like to point out also the Supreme Court's case in Drayton made it clear that, as the court I'm sure recalls, in Drayton you had the two guys together. They got the same bag on the bus. One guy gets arrested because he consents to a search and has dope on him. The other guy says, I was seized when I saw the guy with me get searched because I could no longer think I was free to decline. And the court specifically said, no, somebody around you getting arrested, not just frisked, arrested, doesn't convert your situation into a seizure. So this argument that once the defendant saw other people being frisked, well, that's it. If it wasn't there before, we're at a seizure now. That doesn't hold true because if seeing somebody who you're traveling with and have the same bag get arrested doesn't turn your situation into a seizure. The fact that you see two other people and the cops haven't really paid much attention to you doesn't apply here. So at most, the seizure took place, the attempted seizure, when the police attempted to stop the man. That he certainly didn't submit at that point. There's no question that he continued to try to go away, makes the statement that I'm going home and points to a building that would be different from where his ID indicated he lived. And he had just said he was in the area visiting friends. And then they laid hands on him. That's the first seizure. In my brief, I also went on, gilding the lily probably, but I went on to say that seizure broke when he broke free and continued on. And I was basing that on the testimony of Zastro, who said he broke free, and the testimony of Strayer, who said that he saw the guy run for some distance before the officers were able to catch up with him and tackle him. It is true, as the defendant points out in his reply brief, that Fusco's testimony is not as clear and seems to indicate that he was holding on the whole way, so there might not have been the break. But I would suggest that that's not necessary for this court's finding. I probably should have left that out because we had the seizure, a justifiable seizure, at the point he was first grabbed.
Before you run out of time, can you tell me something about this rule of two?
Your Honor,
rule that's, unlike my colleague, Judge Davis, that's a new one on me.
Your Honor, to anticipate Judge Davis's question, it was a new one on me too. But I'd like to point out that there was more than just the training. And I agree with, I believe it's Judge Gregory, the idea that, well, you can't just decide this will be our rule from now on and we'll cite it whenever, you know, it's convenient.
And then we'll rely on it to justify our search.
And, Your Honor, I see I'm in the red. May I
you can
just
answer
this?
That
thank you.
Briefly.
But I'd like to point out two things with regard to that. First of all, the record was clear that while this was apparently something that was taught at the academy in Charlotte and that the other officer, Strayer, with previous experience had not heard of, both Strayer and Zaslow testified that it was just not their training, that in their experience it had been the situation that that the increased likelihood there'd be another gun around was accurate overall. But it was certainly not, as I put in my brief, inerrantly prophetic by any means. That wasn't the case. Secondly, I'd like to point out that as Judge Whitney found, that certainly wouldn't get you the reasonable suspicion. That would be something that would cause the officers to have a heightened sensitivity and concern that somebody else might be armed. But that certainly doesn't get you there. And if we had that kind of situation where that was the major hook, I hesitate to say major premise, but the major hook of our argument, this would not be a defensible case from the government's point of view.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank
Ms. Hester?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
The government talks a lot about what the police subjectively were focusing on, but that doesn't really matter here because the test is from the objective standpoint of the person who is being seized. So unless those were communicated to Black and his companions, it doesn't really matter that the police were initially focused on Troop and Gates because Black had no way of knowing who they were focusing on. With respect to keeping his handing over the ID and being unusually cooperative, two other people in that group also handed over IDs to Strayer. Those were the people who were sitting closest to him. Moses and Dior also handed their IDs over. So his being unusually cooperative under that circumstance, half of the six men handed their IDs over, and it was in response to the police request that they give over their names and addresses.
Is there testimony as to what order that was done in?
Things were happening at the same time. So the best I can tell, Strayer was talking to two people and Zastro was talking to the other men. So I think that the two other IDs were handed over to Strayer. The government talked about Weaver and tried to compare this case to Weaver, but Weaver's different here because in this case, the police never asked Black for his consent to do anything. In Weaver, the police were specifically asking Weaver, will you come with me? So that's a different situation from someone who's not being asked and in fact is sitting there and watching two men next to him being searched without any consent at all. That distinguishes the Weaver case. The government characterized Black as being extremely nervous, but that's not what the testimony was. The testimony was that he was basically looking back and forth. He was looking to see how many police officers were around him, and he was looking back and forth at other people being searched before he decided to stand up and try to leave. So that is all part of his decision not to continue to consent to what was going on, and that's not something that can be relied on for reasonable suspicion under Massenburg. As far as the rule of two being accurate, the police didn't testify that rule was accurate. Basically, their testimony was that it was hit or miss. Sometimes it worked and sometimes it didn't. So that's not a justification for that rule. With respect to the government describes Black as breaking free, he never broke free. Fusco's testimony was quite clear that he was the one who was standing right next to Black, and he grabbed his shirt and he kept hold of his shirt while Black pulled him along, and he was the one who would have been able to observe that because he was between Zastro and Black, and Zastro testified that yes, Fusco was between him and Black. So Fusco was the best person to know what was going on at that time, and his testimony was undisputed that he had a hold of Black's shirt until he tackled him, and the district court found that the testimony of all of the police officers was credible. So under those circumstances, it's clear and undisputed that Black never broke free, and there was never any testimony that he did break free.
Matter of fact, he held him so long he got a pulse count.
Well, that was Zastra holding onto his arm long enough, yeah, and then he jerked his arm away from Zastra, and then Fusco said he started to try to run, and I grabbed his shirt, and he pulled me along for about 20 feet until I was able to tackle him.
Have you ever had an officer testify that when he grabbed somebody, he was able to determine the pulse count?
No.
Of the person he grabbed?
No.
That's a new one on me, too.
As far as seeing other people get frisked not being a seizure, here the situation is different because he didn't just see people getting asked to be patted down. He saw people getting patted down without being asked first. And they were the two people who were closest to him in order. It was Troop, and then the person next to him was Moses, and that made it appear to any reasonable person in that situation that he was going to be next. And that's why he started looking around and got nervous and stood up. The security perimeter, as far as whether there was anybody else in the parking lot, the testimony was there was no one else in the parking lot. So there was no one to keep away from them. Really, the only purpose for that perimeter could have been to prevent the men from leaving. And certainly that's what they would have thought, regardless of what the police intent was. That's what the people who were surrounded would have thought. Finally, if I can just make one more point about the Hidari D and his submission. The submission was remaining seated while he was within the police security perimeter, not handing over the ID. That was part of it. But really, his submission occurred when he was surrounded and he decided to stay seated and let the police continue on with their investigation. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hester. We'll come down and greet counsel and then go into our next case.